John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my rock?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, August 11, 2011. Israel approves more settlement units in the West Bank, and Netanyahu says the September bid for Palestinian state diminishes chances for peace. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. One Palestinian was killed in an explosion in his house in Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip on Wednesday shortly before midnight. Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, reported that the dead is one of its fighters and identified him as Ali Al-Hajj, 20, from Yibna refugee camp. The Al-Qassam Brigades stated on its website that the fighter was killed by accident, apparently while preparing explosives to use against the Israeli army across the border with the besieged Gaza Strip. The security forces of the deposed Hamas-led government in Gaza initiated an investigation into the incident. In the meantime, the Israeli government decided to start the construction of additional 1,600 apartments for Jewish settlers in occupied East Jerusalem and is expected to approve additional 2,700 units in the coming few days. Few days ago, Israel approved the construction of 930 new settlement units in a settlement to be built on Jabal al-Dik Hill known as Har Humah C. While the Palestinian Authority is heading to the UN in September to request a recognition of an independent Palestinian state on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, Israel continues to build more settlements in the West Bank and more specifically around Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stated that the chances of reaching a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians will diminish should the United Nations approve the Palestinian demand on international recognition of an independent state this September. Netanyahu made his statement following a meeting on Wednesday with 26 U.S. Congress members in Jerusalem. Netanyahu added that the only way to reach a peace treaty with the Palestinians is through direct negotiations. The Palestinian Authority conditioned the restart of peace talks with a complete halt of settlement activities, a request that Israel strongly rejects. In other news, Iran named one of the streets in Tehran after Rachel Khoury, an American activist who was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer in the Gaza Strip in 2003. Khoury came to Palestine in February 2003 as part of the International Solidarity Movement, the ISM, and was killed in March as she was trying to prevent an Israeli military bulldozer from demolishing the house she inhabited with a Palestinian family in Rafah. Until this moment, Israel refuses to run a police investigation into Khoury's death and is satisfied with a military probe that suggests that she was killed when a concrete wall fell on her. That's all for today. You've been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you from Occupied Bethlehem by Hussein Kassis and me, George Dushman.
After years of failed U.S. brokered negotiations for a peace agreement that would establish a Palestinian state alongside Israel, close to 500,000 Israelis now live in settlements on West Bank and East Jerusalem land occupied by Israel since 1967. Palestinians are expected to turn to the United Nations in September for recognition of an independent state on that territory. Recognition would require approval by the five permanent members of the UN Security Council. In July, the U.S. convened a failed last-ditch effort to restart peace negotiations in order to thwart UN action on the Palestinian initiative. According to a July report in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, rather than risk a veto by the United States in the Security Council, the Palestinian Authority is considering turning directly to the UN General Assembly to seek international recognition for a state within the former 1967 borders, but without full member status. Between the lines, Hazel Khan spoke with Jeff Halper, co-founder and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, about the role of the U.S. in peace negotiations, the effort by Palestinians to seek recognition at the UN, and the worldwide movement for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions against Israel to force an end to the occupation of Palestinian territory. Halper believes U.S. policy toward Palestinian aspirations is crucial to Washington's relations with the rest of the world.
I think the United States is becoming very isolated in the world, and especially around the issue of Israel and Palestine. The Israeli occupation of 44 years, that tremendously inflames not only the Arab and Muslim worlds, but way beyond that, it inflames Europe. It's become the equivalent of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. Latin America's up in arms about it. Africa is, it's really the conflict that I think has gripped the world community, maybe not the United States, but the rest of the world. And in a sense, the Israeli occupation is seen as an American Israeli occupation. It's clear that Israel couldn't maintain its control over 4 million Palestinians for a week without the political, military, and financial support of the United States. I don't think Americans are aware of the impact this conflict has on their country, including the fact that the United States is seen as being an enemy of human rights in the world because of its stands to support Israel with its flagrant violations of international law and human rights. And the United States is seen as really giving only one thing to the world, and that's military weaponry to dictatorial regimes. This issue is really isolating the U.S. We've been witnessing a so-called American-brokered negotiations between the Israelis and Palestinians. The United States was pretending to be an honest broker. For 20 years, Israel's continued to build settlements. There are now 500,000 Israeli settlers. There were about 150,000 when the peace process, so-called, began 20 years ago. The negotiations have simply broken down completely. And yet the United States keeps saying negotiations are the only way out. And yet the United States supports Israel completely in terms of building settlements and doing everything that neutralizes negotiations. If negotiations are over, there's only one remaining course for the Palestinians. And that is to go to the United Nations in September when the United Nations reconvenes and to ask for full membership as the state of Palestine within the 1967 borders, which is the two-state solution, and ask for full membership in the United Nations. A state on 22% of historic Palestine. The Palestinians aren't asking anything that threatens Israel, takes any Israeli territory. In fact, Israel remains on 78% of the country. Now, the problem is that an application for membership of the UN has to go through the Security Council. Mm-hmm. And the United States has already announced that it's going to veto a Palestinian state. Why it should veto a Palestinian state is simply not clear. And I think everyone should ask the member of Congress why. Because it's actually Congress that's Israel's strongest and staunchest ally. Congress will not allow the Obama administration, even if it wanted to allow a genuine Palestinian state to emerge. If the Palestinians cannot get a two-state solution through the Security Council, even though in the General Assembly they have the votes probably for recognition, the General Assembly can't overrule the Security Council. What's going to happen, in my view, is something very serious. I think the Palestinian Authority is going to resign or collapse. Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, is simply going to say, what's my function? If there's no political process, there's no negotiations, and the United States will not allow a Palestinian state to emerge, then what am I? I'm simply a collaborator. Israel's policeman in the occupied territories. I think Abu Mazen is weak, but he's not a collaborator. If he resigns, Israel is going to have to reoccupy the West Bank, including all the Palestinian cities. And it's going to have to reoccupy Gaza. You remember the terrible invasion of Gaza a couple of years ago, because it can't allow Hamas to step into the vacuum. The very threat of an Israeli reoccupation would so inflame the world that it would force the international community to intervene. And I think Americans are going to find themselves completely adrift in the world. So I think there's a lot riding on this, not only for the Palestinians, of course, but for the United States as well.
So you mentioned in some of the things you've written recently that the Palestinians' real support is coming from international civil society rather than from any particular national alliances. Is there something we as part of the civil society could be doing, should be doing?
The depressing thing is that the governments are not our friends. They don't represent us. They're not honest with us. They don't deal with us, the people. And the only way we can sort of make our will felt is to resist, is to gum up the system. The governments were living very well with apartheid until the civil society began an international campaign of sanctions that finally so embarrassed the governments, including the Reagan government, that they had to somehow adopt the sanctions themselves. In other words, governments will not do the right thing, period, unless they're pushed by the people. So I'm saying, you know, there should be a call to mobilize. We should get 100, 200,000 people on the streets of New York City at the UN headquarters towards the end of September to give tremendous civil society support to the Palestinian application for membership.
That was Jeff Halper, co-founder and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Tony Ernst assisted in the production of this segment. Find links to more information on the Palestinian Initiative to Gain Recognition for Statehood on our website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan today. NATO is reporting the deaths of 5 soldiers of unreported nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan yesterday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Monday. Another Chinook helicopter crash-landed in eastern Afghanistan just days after the downing of the one carrying the 30 U.S. soldiers who were killed. This time, the helicopter was a Chinook flying in Paktia province to pick up special operations troops, but it suffered a mechanical failure and crashed. The crew was rescued by other troops. Afghanistan, Tuesday. NATO reports an airstrike killed Taliban leader Mullah Mohibullah and the insurgent who, quote, fired the shot associated with the downing of a C-47 helicopter in the Tongji Valley last Saturday. Okay, SEAL Team 6 killed Osama bin Laden, then the Taliban shot down 22 members of SEAL Team 6 on that helicopter. Now the fighters who shot it down have in turn been killed. Sounds to me like tit-for-tat gang warfare, like what I used to see in Pet Word. Afghanistan, Wednesday. In Ghazni, NATO troops fought against Afghan police manning a checkpoint in Ghazni City before the two groups realized the mistake. The NATO troops approached the checkpoint while on a nighttime patrol through the area, Provincial Police Chief General Zawahar Zahid said. The Afghan police saw armed men and asked them to stop and started firing when the NATO troops did not, Zahid said. The exchange of gunfire lasted about 15 minutes and no NATO or Afghan forces were killed. Lucky this time, next time they might not be. Pakistan, Wednesday. Taliban-linked militants in Pakistan blew up yet another NATO oil truck carrying fuel for U.S.-led foreign troops in Afghanistan, local officials reported. Baghdad, Wednesday. Two Katyusha rockets fell in a fortified green zone, but losses were not known, a security source reported. Mosul, Iraq, yesterday. Two roadside bombs targeted police patrols, one wounding a cop and the other wounding a child, according to a police source in Nineveh province. Kirkuk, Iraq, Tuesday. An explosive charge hit an American Army patrol in southern Kirkuk's industrial district. Kirkuk, Iraq, Tuesday. A second U.S. Army patrol was, quote, exposed for a bomb attack, with no damage occurring, according to the same source who reported the first one. Wait a minute. What U.S. Army patrols? What bomb attacks? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Oh yeah, that's been said before. Remember George W. Bush and mission accomplished? Mr. Barack Obama, now's the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today.
In its war on terrorism, the Bush administration created two special prisons in the United States known as Communication Management Units, or CMUs, designed to house terrorist-linked federal inmates. A proposal for these special units was drafted in 2006, but the rules were never officially approved. The prisons were opened in late 2006 and limited an inmate's communication to the outside world to one single-page letter a week, one 15-minute phone call per month, and one hour-long visit per month with family members. Civil rights groups, including the ACLU, objected to the new prison rules as unconstitutional, but these concerns were ignored as the Federal Bureau of Prisons opened the first CMU facility in Terre Haute, Indiana. News of the unit leaked from a letter sent by convicted inmate Rafael Dafir when he was transferred to the CMU unit. In his letter, Dafir said 14 of the 16 inmates in the unit were Muslims, and the rules were so restrictive that inmates could not hug or kiss family members. The federal government opened a second CMU facility in Marion, Illinois in 2008. According to The Nation magazine, a special effort has been made to bring non-Muslims into the facility, specifically targeting animal rights activists linked to the Animal Liberation Front. In March 2010, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a lawsuit on behalf of CMU inmates, charging the U.S. government with violating the First, Fifth, and Eighth Amendments to the Constitution. The suit alleges the communication management units are discriminatory and punitive in nature. 8 days after the suit was filed, the Obama administration proposed a new rule that expanded the scope of CMU facilities to cover any prisoner, including those held as witnesses. Most inmates incarcerated in the units have been convicted of providing material support to terrorist-linked groups, but not committing acts of violence themselves.
You've probably heard about the massive riots in London that looked like the Blitz in World War II. You may even have heard that the fighting started when the police shot somebody who had not shot at them. Just like Mount Pleasant in 1991 or Overtown, Miami in 1989. What the news is not talking about is how that shooting just lit the fuse. It took years of the rich treating the poor like dog crap. Build up the explosive mixture now detonating on your TV set.
I'm now joined by Darkus Howe, who is a writer and broadcaster. And you can speak to him now. And Marcus Dow is in Croydon. Marcus Dow, are you shocked by what you've seen there last night?
No, not at all. I have been living in London for 50 years. There are so many different moods and moments. But what I was certain about, listening to my grandson and my son, is that something very, very serious was going to take place in this country. Our political leaders had no idea. The police had no idea. But if you looked at young blacks and young whites with a discerning eye and a careful hearing, they have been telling us, and we would not listen, that what is happening in this country to them.
Mr. Howe, if I can just stop you, Mr. Howe, for a moment. You say you're not shocked. Does this mean that you condone what happened in your community last night?
I condone, of course not. What I'm going to condone it for? What I'm concerned about more than anything else, there is a young man called Mark Duggan. He has parents, he has brothers, he has sisters, and few yards away from where he lives, a police officer blew his head off.
Well, Mr. Howe, we have to... Mr. Howe, we have to wait for the official inquiry before we can say things like that. We don't know what happened to Mr. Duggan. We are going to wait for the police report on it.
Bullshit, lady. This is the same swell the cops always try to serve up. Just like Overtown, just like Mount Pleasant.
They have been stopping and searching young blacks for no reason at all. I have a grandson, he's an angel, and he began to think he was coming of age when the police slapped him up against the wall and searched him, and he thought he had now had a gold star. I asked him the other day, apropos of a sense that something was going seriously wrong in this country, I said, how many times have the police searched you? He said, Papa, I can't count. There's so many times.
That sounds like New York City might be next in line for the class war blitz, with the New York pigs having a stop-and-frisk policy aimed at non-white teenagers. Silver Spring should also listen good. London was one of the first cities to deploy the Mosquito, a high-pitched sound device aimed at driving away teenagers, with over 30,000 in use. Silver Spring, if you take similar measures against young people, look out. Gallery Place, I'll bet you sure are glad you decided to slap that mosquito and turn it off. Stop making war on young people and young people of color, or they will surely make war on you.
Where were you in 1981 in Brixton?
Mr.
They had I don't call it rioting, I call it an insurrection of the masses of the people. It is happening in Syria, it is happening in Clapham, it's happening in Liverpool, it's happening in Port of Spain, Trinidad, and that is the nature of the historical moment.
You heard that, New York. You heard that, Silver Spring. You heard that, Prince George's County. Take your stop and frisk, your curfews, your dance hall licensing and your go-go crackdowns, and all your mosquitoes, and stick them where the sun doesn't shine, or you may be next.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com.
Head rock, DJ Munch. chocolate city. This is a movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown. Ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping. Come, they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Thumping.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave labors. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market. Hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than their male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about chocolate city unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart, it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holler black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember, DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister. Strom Thurmond, similar. Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee a plantation mentality. Results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they want to come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmart's in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
On the 5th of August, several hundred protesters representing unions, Walmart employees who would prefer a union to the current low wages, and D.C. residents blocked 8th Street Northwest in front of D.C.'s lobbying headquarters. Here's why one speaker said Walmart would be a bad idea for D.C. under their current business practices.
They are, in fact, confused about what our issue is with Walmart. In fact, while I was waiting for my brothers and sisters from Jobs for Justice, Massachusetts to show up, because I have been here earlier today for meetings, I had a brother come up to me and said, look, man, why are they upset with Walmart? We need Walmart. Just like, brother, let me explain to you what this is all about. Because I'm clear that you're not reading the papers, you're not watching the news, all you're hearing is the hype. Let me explain to you. Do you know what they do to women? Do you have any idea where their clothing comes from? And do you know how they treat those workers, where that clothing comes from, in Vietnam and Southeast Asia and other places? Do you have any idea how workers are treated at their stores, anywhere? There's no way that Walmart pays you enough to sustain a family. There's no way that Walmart pays you enough to give you health benefits. There's no way that Walmart allows you, particularly if you're black, brown, and female, to give you an opportunity for advancement, for growth, so that you can continue to build this, whatever this thing called the American dream is supposed to be, or certainly was in my parents' lifetime, because I ain't seen it yet. And I certainly, and all of us recognize that, you know, hey, they're in business to make money. It's called capitalism. That's what, you know, everybody's okay with capitalism except for us, right? But, you know, but the truth is, with the way Walmart treats workers, the way Walmart treats communities, it's not just the workers that go down, communities go down when Walmart comes to town. Okay? Businesses that have been in communities for years and years and years cease to exist once Walmart comes to town.
You heard that? We really want to have Georgia Avenue and three other communities in D.C. cease to exist so we can have Walmart instead.
They're protesting against the exploitation of Native American farm workers by Trader Joe's. Just to get a penny more a pound for tomatoes, they're paid next to nothing unless they get this contract. They've been successful with Burger King and with a number of other major buyers of tomatoes. It's Trader Joe's turn to learn not to exploit their workers.
In early June, over 500 people, both locals and outside supporters, recreated the 1921 Miners' March on Blair Mountain, West Virginia. The march, 90 years ago, demanded union rights and pitted thousands of armed miners against coal company security guards, county sheriffs, and ultimately the U.S. Army. The goal of this year's march was to protect Blair Mountain, a national historic site, from mountaintop removal coal extraction, to end all mountaintop removal mining in Appalachia, and to promote local jobs and sustainable communities. The struggle to end mountaintop removal coal mining has attracted prominent supporters, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and musicians Ashley Judd, Emmylou Harris, and others. Many union members joined the week-long march on Blair Mountain. However, the United Mine Workers Union withdrew its early endorsement of the march because, while it favors protection of Blair Mountain, it does not oppose mountaintop removal coal extraction that provides local jobs. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus was on the march for three of the 5 days, and midway through the trek interviewed Chuck Keeney, one of the protest action's organizers. He teaches Appalachian history at a local college and is the great-grandson of Frank Keeney, a leader of the United Mine Workers Union that fought on Blair Mountain in 1921. Keeney talks about the lack of knowledge among many West Virginians about their own history and how this year's march on Blair Mountain has brought miners and environmentalists together.
I learned nothing about Blair Mountain or the West Virginia Mine Wars in school. I learned it like much of the real history of Appalachia that you learn. It's a place without a formal history. It's a place where you learn it at family reunions. You learn it at church potluck dinners. You learn it, you know, at Christmas time. You learn it from songs. You learn it from poetry. You don't learn it in school because what you get in school is largely dictated by a big industry.
So how have things gone so far in terms of what you kind of expected, what you hoped?
You know what? Things have gone better than I expected. We've hit our obstacles. A lot of them have been small little obstacles, but there's been no violence towards the marchers. This was something that I was incredibly concerned about. I don't know if you've heard the story of the march that they tried to do in 1999, in which people were assaulted. In fact, Ken Heckler, the former Secretary of State, was beaten up, and he was 84 at the time. He was beaten to a bloody pulp by a bunch of guys hired by the coal companies. So none of that has happened yet. And so we're very happy about that. Also very happy about the media coverage, the fact that we're able to. I went on a right-wing radio show, and I got to talk to them for 30 minutes and had them saying that all of my goals were reasonable by the end of the discussion. The idea that I was able to do that was just pretty mind-blowing to me. Now, of course, they've done a number of things, like the campsites. The coal companies have used intimidation to shut down the campsites of places where we would have camped. But it tells me that they're afraid of us. It tells us that they fear the impact that we may have.
Massey, which has now been bought by Alpha Natural Resources, and another company, Arch Coal, both have options to blast on Blair Mountain. Mm-hmm. And has there been any change? I mean, you have to basically discourage them from doing that.
Yeah, well, we have to get Blair Mountain put back on the National Register of Historic Places, which would protect it. And there are other ways in which we can protect the site. The government can do that. I'm not holding my breath that the state government is going to do that, because the state government is very much on the side of the coal companies. But the federal government can do this. The federal government can declare it a National Historic Site and can protect it. So we want, that's one of the reasons we're trying to do this, to get the attention of the nation so that the public can email the National Register of Historic Places, try to get our president to perhaps intervene at some point and save this national treasure. This is a history that very few people even know. You know, and when we tell them about it, people are like, wow, what an amazing, unique story. And, you know, this is where people laid the groundwork for an American middle class, for weekends, for 40-hour work weeks. And if you think labor organizations aren't important now, look at Wisconsin, look at Michigan, look at all of the things that's happening. These issues are incredibly important, and Blair Mountain is a place where people can rally to that and, you know, see that labor is something that's vitally important to the economic prosperity of the United States.
People on the march have some different points of view. I mean, some people really think we got to stop coal mining, totally. I mean, as soon as possible, not necessarily, you know, it won't happen right away. But then there's other people who say, you know, what we need is more underground coal mining because it's more jobs and we need the energy. And so you think people can coexist with different points of view and still have the goals?
Well, you know what? We have coexisted. The example that is most pertinent to me happened a couple weeks before the march. And I was at Matewan. And Matewan is the heart, the belly of the beast of coal country in West Virginia. And I was giving a speech at a union local. Had about 40 coal miners and their families, and then we had about 40 or so environmentalists there. And they were all eating hot dogs together, joking together. We had a talk, you know, and we had a big open discussion. And after the talk, people were coming up to me and saying, this is the first time this has ever happened, that environmentalists and coal miners and union people were sitting under the same roof, talking things out. And that's what Blair Mountain is. It's, you know, not everybody's going to agree 100%, but Blair Mountain is a place where people that are have these progressive views, environmentalists, labor unions, historic preservationists, can all kind of come together. And if these groups don't find a way to come together, then they are going to separately be crushed. They have to find a way to work through their differences and come together. And Blair Mountain, I think, is a place in which that can happen.
That was Chuck Keeney, an organizer of June's protest march on Blair Mountain, West Virginia. For more information on the campaign to end mountaintop removal coal mining, visit our website at btlonline.org.
Here is an update on a tree sit that has stopped blasting at the Bee Tree Mountaintop Removal Coal Mine in West Virginia. Out of the two original tree sitters, one of them, Bex Collins, had to come down at the two-week mark, but the other tree sitter, Catherine Ann, is determined to stay. On the 11th of August, she woke up to find two hired security guards sitting at the bottom of her tree. She is 80 feet up, out of reach of bucket trucks and other such equipment. Meanwhile, the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection just held another phony public hearing on the Bee Tree surface mine, and it was evident to everyone there that the DEP was siding with Alpha Minerals, the company that bought out Massey Energy, the former owner of the mine. The message is obvious. Direct action talks, hot air from bureaucrats at fake public hearings walks. Catherine Ann could turn out to be another Julia Butterfly, the woman who sat in a redwood for 18 months to shut down an old-growth logging site in California. Legally, the mine cannot blast because Catherine Ann's tree is in a 500-foot safety zone. An 18-month shutdown of production could financially cripple the mine, hopefully shutting it down for good and saving Coal River Mountain.
Across India, farmers have resisted government demands to sell their land to make way for new industry and development projects. India's land seizure law developed under British colonial rule. The 1894 Land Acquisition Act usually only pays farmers a fraction of the land's actual value. This law has broken down as farmers and their allies have balked at billions of dollars in new development projects to fuel India's high growth and increased prosperity. According to the Washington Post, the land conflicts have become politically explosive since the prime land for development and industry is located in fertile and densely populated regions near major cities and water supplies. After a five-year fight, South Korea's POSCO Corporation recently acquired land for a $12 billion steel plant. But other big companies, like Tata Motors, have abandoned plans to build new factories after farmers put up strong resistance. In May, the Communist Party of India, which has ruled the Indian state of West Bengal for nearly 35 years, was voted out of office due to anger over rapid industrialization at the expense of farmers. The winner, Mamata Banerjee of the Trinamool Congress Party, championed the farmers' cause as she became the first woman chief minister of West Bengal.